Good evening and welcome to the October 2025 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Moralia. Well, tonight we've got some really fascinating guests, starting with Bill Glenn, a local Sonoma County man who at the age of 75 was ordained as a priest last summer in the Episcopal Church. Bill's book, I Came Here Seeking a Person, tells his personal story escaping from the Catholic Church as a gay man. His life story is really interesting and I can't wait for you to meet him. And then Finn Dearhart shares his conversation with Griffin Hansberry, the author of Some Strange Music Draws Me In. And of course, Rafe DeRozzi will be here with this month's HIV Roundup. It's all coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio News for this Sunday, October 26th, 2025. This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for the week of October 26th, 2025. This month, President Donald Trump commuted the more than seven-year federal prison sentence of former U.S. Representative George Santos. He's the disgraced gay New York Republican who became a national symbol of political deceit before his expulsion from Congress. Trump announced the decision on Truth Social, calling Santos, quote, somewhat of a rogue, end quote, and claiming his punishment was excessive. He compared Santos's conduct to Democratic Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal's past misstatements about military service, calling Blumenthal, quote, a complete and total fraud, end quote. Trump said Santos had been horribly mistreated and held in solitary confinement for long stretches. And he added, quote, I just signed a commutation releasing George Santos from prison immediately. Good luck, George. Have a great life, end quote. Santos, who was 37 at the time, pleaded guilty to 23 felony counts, including wire fraud, identity theft, and falsifying records. Prosecutors said he fabricated campaign loans, stole donor identities, and spent political contributions on luxury goods, Botox, and online subscriptions. Last April, a federal judge sentenced him to 87 months in prison and ordered him to repay hundreds of thousands of dollars. He began serving that sentence in July at the Federal Correctional Institution in Fairton, New Jersey. And in New York, when the National Park Service quietly stripped references to transgender and bisexual people from the website of Stonewall's National Monument, Democratic lawmakers saw more than a bureaucratic editing. They saw a pattern. A week ago Friday, more than 70 House Democrats, led by Representatives Don Goldman of New York, Mark Tectano of California, and Richie Torres of New York, demanded that Interior Secretary Doug Burgum and Acting National Park Service Director Jessica Boren reverse the so-called, quote, blatant attack on the integrity of public history, end quote. In a letter obtained by The Advocate magazine, the members denounced the administration's efforts to rewrite history across national parks, and warn that similar edits are appearing in official interpretations of Japanese-American incarceration, Native American massacres, and slavery. The 72 lawmakers who participated wrote that the history of Stonewall cannot be told without the story of transgender Americans, adding that the erasure from the national narrative undermines the credibility of the Park Service and betrays the ideals of equality and justice the monument was created to honor. In an exclusive interview with The Advocate, Representative Goldman called the revisions, quote, shameful and outrageous, end quote. He said that the deletion of trans identities from official government platforms demeans humanity and undermines everything this country stands for. And he added, quote, the idea of individual freedom to be who we want to be is such a fundamental American value, and this effort to delete not only transgender people, but the notion of transgender identity itself is an attempt to rewrite science, history, and truth, end quote. The Stonewall National Monument, established by President Barack Obama back in 2016, was the first unit of the National Park System dedicated to LGBTQ+ equality, and it commemorates the 1969 uprising outside New York's Stonewall Inn. And here in California, after months of some gentle nudging, out California Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco has announced he's entering the race to succeed former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. 2 years ago, Wiener, a prolific 55-year-old San Francisco legislator, launched an exploratory committee for the seat that Pelosi, who's now 85 years old, has held since 1988. Last March, Wiener said he'd wait to launch a campaign until after Pelosi retired, saying it would be an honor to succeed her. But in June, he filed preliminary paperwork to run, stating, quote, I've been clear that I intended to run for this seat whenever the race opens up, whether in 2026 or 2028, end quote. And also in California, with the end of the legislative session last month, Lawmakers sent Governor Newsom a flurry of bills designed to shore up protections in the state for the LGBTQ plus community and transgender rights as the White House crusade against LGBTQ plus identity presses on. One of the bills that the governor vetoed was Assembly Bill 86, a measure which would have tweaked language about health education standards for kindergarten through eighth grade. Republicans had latched on to the legislation as an example of, quote, gender ideology at work in state government. The bill would have required the introduction that the theory of reproductive anatomy does not necessarily determine a person's gender. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. Well, many of us grew up in a church that rejected us once discovering that we are gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. And it's really not an uncommon experience for LGBTQ plus people to have to reconcile their faith with who they are in order to live an authentic life. Bill Glenn's story growing up in the Catholic Church and almost becoming a priest is really pretty fascinating. And what a full life he continues to live. The book with his story is titled, I Came Here Seeking a Person. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. It was lovely to meet you earlier this fall over some coffee, and great to have you on as a guest. Your story is fascinating, and let's start with, you know, your experience growing up in the Catholic Church, and then what drew you into the church's really a vocation?
Well, that's a complicated answer. I'll do my best to briefen it. I grew up in an intensely Irish Catholic family, of 10 people in the Midwest in the 50s and 60s. My family was pretty devout. Went to a Catholic grammar school, which meant we went to mass every day. And then I went to a Jesuit high school, a Jesuit university. And then I entered the Jesuits when I graduated college, and I was a Jesuit for 10 years. So the evolution felt very natural until it didn't.
And was there a moment, or was there just a period of time that suddenly you discovered this isn't syncing up?
There was a moment, actually. I was drinking alcoholically while I was studying to be a priest, and I was deeply in the closet. I mean, deeply in the closet with all the self-harangement that meant. Mm-hmm. And I was riding my bike. I was teaching at Jesuit prep school in Milwaukee. I was riding my bike on Lake Michigan, Lake Drive, and I heard the words, you never have to drink again. And I've been sober 47 years. It was like lightning. A month later, I came out of the closet, hence realizing what I was drinking around was suppressing my sexuality and many other things. And when I came out of the closet, it was because Harvey Milk was having a rally in the Civic Center in San Francisco prior to a really heinous amendment on the state ballot.
Sure.
And he shamed me into coming out by saying, we're here today because we're free. We're here for the little girl in Bakersfield, the little boy in Fresno. And I'm thinking, these tears started streaming down my eyes. I'm thinking, I'm not free. That was my day of freedom. I took the Roman collar out of my shirt and in essence, never looked back.
Oh my gosh. That gives me chills to hear that. Just gives me chills. For you, it was Harvey Milk. For me, it was Matthew Shepard, who I will always be grateful to.
Me too, to Harvey Milk and to Matthew Shepard.
Yeah.
Who gave his life for this.
For sure, for sure. Well, you've had just an amazing, fascinating career. I learned about it first reading your book and then talking with you in person. And one of the things that struck me is all the work you did during the 1970s and then into the 80s with the AIDS crisis. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, obviously Harvey Milk drew you into this community, and then it feels like you just jumped into it and all of a sudden you're completely immersed. What were the 1980s like?
3 years after Harvey Milk pulled me out of the closet, I met my now husband, 44 years. And we started our merry little life together in 1981. And a year later, in winter of 1982, we read a little blurb in The Advocate, which at that time was a very commonly read gay newspaper out of Los Angeles. And it had an article about these five men in San Francisco, LA, and New York who had been identified by doctors as having this rare cancer. We thought nothing of it.
Mm-hmm.
Within a year, many of our friends started to get sick. It wasn't identified as HIV. And then a friend was diagnosed on Thursday and he died on Sunday. So we knew we had to go into action, both my husband and I. And I was involved in the AIDS epidemic for 15 years. I was on a couple of boards. I chaired the San Francisco AIDS Foundation board. I ran a health clinic in the Tenderloin in San Francisco for triply diagnosed people, mostly men, mentally ill, substance abusing, and late stage HIV. I worked in a couple of hospitals doing counseling for men who had just gotten their test results. And the umbrella for all of that was our friends who were dying. And it's not a stretch to say the whole cohort of friends I met when I came out in the late 80s or late 70s, all but one died by 1989.
Mm.
So we were in a constant state of grief, although we didn't recognize that as such because we had to keep doing the work. It really wasn't until years later that I began to grapple with the grief. I regard anyone who lived during that time and worked or lived and died in the epidemic as having suffered a version of PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
It was a traumatic and it was an isolating experience because in the initial years, there was no response from the non-gay world, right, including in San Francisco. That would change over time, but we were living in a cyclone, and the cyclone never took a break. And it taught me everything about how to be a man, how to be a friend, how to be a servant, how to be a human being. It really taught me how to be a human being.
Well, thank goodness you had your husband at your side. I can't imagine being so immersed in that alone. And
I'm grateful too.
And your husband, Scott's family really, really joined this work, yeah, didn't they? Talk a little bit about that.
His parents, we were out, of course, to our families and fully embraced. And Scott's parents grew to like many of our friends. And as they got diagnosed and were dying, they felt helpless. So his mom, Mary, came to me. I was chair of the board of the AIDS Foundation. She said, "What can I do?" And I said, "You can come on the board and teach these young gay men how to raise money," because she was a junior league fundraiser. She came on the board. She stayed for 3 years. She was present for these conversations with doctors about how the sexual transmission went all the way up to fisting. And she sat there like a trooper. And then when she moved to Sonoma County, she took on a young man with HIV disease and was his companion until his death. So they were really quite remarkable. They're both deceased now. They were quite remarkable people.
You're not kidding. And what's sort of, I've just continued to find interesting about our stories and the parallels is I had a chance to meet them through a friend of mine and had no idea about any of this and any of this incredible work that they were doing. I remember them as being wonderful people, very community oriented, and just really warm to be around. But I had no idea that they were so engaged in a community that, of course, at that time I wasn't out or a part of either. This book I really found fascinating. It's called I Came Here Seeking a Person, One Man's Spiritual Journey. And you talk about your journey, but how did you end up in the Episcopal Church? I get what happened with the Catholic Church, but how did you find the Episcopal Church?
Well, I stayed worshiping with the Catholic Church for about 10 years after I left the Jesuits, and it was during the epidemic, and I would go to church, and there was no consciousness of AIDS right outside the door, and it became very discouraging for me. And I heard a voice one day. I'm very intuitive, and I heard this voice driving in my car on Folsom Street, I will note, and the voice said, "You can't stay in the shadow any longer." And like many voices that I've heard, it was an invitation to move on with your life. So I started worshiping at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, which is a magnificent Anglo-Catholic church. And I have really been worshiping with the Episcopalians on and off ever since then. And I found my way to the parish where I'm working now, and for which, as you'll probably ask, I was recently ordained a priest. About 20 years ago, I left it and then I came back, and I have found really a magnificent spiritual home for myself. And extraordinarily loving community of 150, 200 people.
We've talked over the years on this show about, you know, how LGBT people have to often reconcile who they are with their faith. And some never come and find a faith tradition, and others find their way back. And it's difficult. But for those people who don't know about the Episcopal Church, what is its history? I know it's centuries old, but what is its history with the Catholic Church? And what might people find who are former recovered Catholics like myself in the Episcopal Church that would welcome them?
You know, I'd say about the Episcopal Church is for the past going on 50 years, they've done their work. They started to ordain women in the late 70s. They ordained a black woman as a bishop in the late 70s. They started ordaining a lot of women. There's, I'm sure, parity now among the ordained between men and women. And they took on the issue of homosexuality. During the epidemic, Grace Cathedral was a center of a lot of HIV activity. The church really opened its doors, as did many Episcopal churches. A couple of Catholic churches did, but most of the Catholic churches just buried their head in the sand.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a profound homophobia in the church, in the Catholic Church. So many gay priests are utterly closeted, and the patriarch reigns supreme. So the Episcopalians, my parish, for instance, the rector, the pastor, is a straight man with a wife and two kids. His wife's a doctor. And he encouraged me to be ordained, so I'm his assistant pastor. About a third to half of our community are former Roman Catholics. There's probably 20 to 30 gay people. There's a couple of trans couples. I mean, it's just a welcome home to a very rich spiritual life. I don't know any place like it, and I know other Episcopal churches like it, but outside of the Episcopal Church, it's very social justice oriented, and it's also committed to the spiritual life. Mm-hmm. It's a remarkable place, and I feel so blessed to have found this or been found. I'm an old guy, and I'm really glad in my last, however long I have, that I'm a priest there. It's an honor and a joy for me.
Hmm. It's very comforting to hear that. And I remember part of our conversation over coffee was that I told you that I was in the midst of a bit of a spiritual crisis myself. And you asked me my age, and you said, well, it's right on time. But then I never followed up with a question of, okay, tell me more about that. So for our listeners who might be in my generation.
Right, and what generation is that, Ray?
Early 60s. Early 60s.
Oh, you young people.
Tell me about this. Tell me about what you mean that it's right on time.
When I left the Jesuits, I went back to school and got a degree in clinical psych, and I had a private practice and a hospital-based practice for 35 years. Mm-hmm. I saw a lot of gay men. I saw a lot of straight men. Women seem to do their work because they have a little more access to their emotions. And because they have access to their emotions, they share more readily with people. They often have a lot of girlfriends, and they talk about what's going on in their lives. Men don't. The biggest crisis in American masculinity is loneliness. So if a man is not beginning his work, and by his work, I mean doing the work to become conscious, awake, alert, alive, loving, affectionate, intimate, by his early mid-50s, he's not going to do it. Mm-hmm. He'll stay in his pattern. He'll retire 65, 68, 70. His wife will be totally engaged with her life, often. She'll be engaged in clubs and organizations and church and girlfriends and bridge and social service, schools. And the men dry up because they understood themselves as workers, as achievers, as success. Success defined the man. Success doesn't define anything.
Mm-hmm.
So a big part of the journey of a man is to recover a faith life or recover a life of finding meaning, deeper meaning than the workplace. And the workplace can be a wonderfully meaningful place, but it's the workplace. So if men are not doing this work, in my experience, and I'm speaking only from my own experience, by their mid men would come into therapy, straight men in particular, in their early 50s, and they'd be lost. And their wives had finally said, go in to find a therapist. I was fortunate that they found me, and they would come in and they would be at sea. They had buried their feelings, their traumas, their pain for decades. And it's work to uncover that stuff and be freed of it to the degree it's possible. We're never fully freed of our past. But they found a gift in themselves and it renewed their lives. I had a guy, I'm very fond of this guy. And he happily married kids, and he had a very close friend who was a woman who was in their social circle. And he asked me for permission to go to lunch with her. I'm going, excuse me? He didn't think he could go to lunch with a woman who wasn't his wife. In our community, that stricture would be regarded as ridiculous. That was one of many examples. He wondered if he could ask a male friend out to dinner. I'm going, tonight? Call him tonight. He's out, he's ready. I mean, and that's the outer layer. The inner layer was feelings of shame, inadequacy, failure, isolation. So I'm glad you're doing your work and you've been doing your work for a while. You've got your butt out of the closet and you're alive. I can see it in your face right now, and I saw it when we met not so long ago.
I mean, for I like you, I grew up in the Catholic Church, but didn't go to a Catholic school, and I was an altar boy and all of that. I shared a lot of that with you, went through all of the sacraments and so forth, but also felt and still feel very, very betrayed. And thought I maybe had reconciled all of that, but really haven't. And so it just feels like a bit of a crisis and a bit of doubt about all of this. For folks like me, talk about coming to incarnation. What can they expect? And what was that like for you to be ordained? I mean, those are probably two separate questions, but I'm curious about both.
I would venture that in the Bay Area, I don't know an exception to what I'm about to say, every Episcopal church is welcoming. Almost every Episcopal church has this little banner outside saying, a gay flag banner saying, all welcome. It's a legitimate statement. You go into the suburbs, go into the East Bay, go into the city, go to South Bay, North Bay. You'll find gay priests in many of these parishes. You'll have thriving communities, including gay communities. The liturgy will be so similar to the Catholic Church. My family, I have eight sibs, they come out here with their kids and they come to Incarnation and they go, is this a Catholic Church? I go, no, it's not a Catholic Church. They go, well, the Mass is so similar. It's so similar, except the gospel that's preached is a gospel of justice and love, not of rules and dogma. You go to coffee afterwards and everyone's hugging one another. I had never seen such a thing in the Catholic Church. It's a place of warmth, of depth, of real spiritual life, of service to the community. At our church, we serve 100, 120 unhoused, mainly men, beginning at 6 in the morning on Sundays for 2 hours. Cold breakfast, hot breakfast, bag lunch, clothing, blankets. And we've been doing this for 12 years. And it's totally volunteer run by the parish, and it's like a lot of business people could come and see this in operation and learn how to run something. It's a gift to us. We're the ones who benefit from it. I know our folks who come benefit, but it's the redoubt is to us spiritually and psychologically. So
Amazing.
I'll use one word. What I found in incarnation that is a weird word for me because I'm Irish and the Irish do not use this word. I found joy. I didn't even know what that meant. I know it was on Christmas cards, Joya. I found joy at Incarnation, and I've been there back there for 5 years. I find joy every time I'm there. And that's not an exaggeration. And I'm not like sending little sweet cards to people saying, live a joyful life. Ah, that's not my style. But I found true joy there.
Amazing. Amazing. So you were ordained. That was not part of your plan, though, right? I mean, you were invited
I
to
was
start another
retired. I wrote
career.
my book. I thought I'd have a Netflix life. I could finally watch the hundreds of Netflix stories I had saved. And my pastor, Stephen Shaver, who is a quite remarkable man, was 30 years younger than me, took me out to lunch. We used to go to lunch. And at lunch one day, he said, do you still think about being ordained? And I looked at him like this. I said, Stephen, do you know how old I am? I'm currently 77. And he said, yes. I go, So I said, do you know I spent 10 years of my life getting ready to be ordained a Catholic priest? And he says, yes. I said, why would you ask me this? I was a little annoyed, a little curious. And he said, because you are a priest. Mm. And I want you to, in the Episcopal Church to use your gifts here. I was 72 or 3 at the time. I was dumbfounded. Tears started to come out of my eyeballs. And it happened pretty quickly. 3 years later, I was ordained this past summer at an incredibly beautiful ceremony at the Cathedral in Sacramento. I had friends come from all of the United States, including my first girlfriend from 1964, and her husband came from Farmington, Maine. I had only seen her twice in 55 years. It was that kind of a joyful celebration.
Wow. Congratulations. That's really amazing. Really wonderful.
Thank you. It's been amazing for me, and it's a total gift.
Well, what would you recommend for those of us who are in the midst of crisis? What's the first step?
If your crisis is spiritual, I would recommend finding a church, and don't search endlessly. There's no perfect church at all. There's no perfect pastor or rector or preacher, although there are some pretty damn good ones. And stay for a while. You're going to find all the things you don't like immediately. Oh my God, they do that here? Forget it. Stay. And see what happens to you. Mm-hmm. I want to speak back to what you said about having resentment against the Roman Church. I had that too. Not a lot, because I felt so free finally. And I have sadness for the Roman Church. I love so much about the Catholic Church. And I have so many dear friends who are Catholic priests. And I have sadness. I've let go of my anger. I had anger for about 10 years. And I had to let it go. It was crippling me. It was of no value. Mm-hmm. There's good anger to have in life. I was changing nothing in the Catholic Church. My job was to change me and to continue to grow. I have many friends here who are still faithful Catholics, and they struggle. They struggle. They find it so difficult to stay. I found it difficult to leave, and when I left, I'm so grateful for my life journey. And I write about it in the book you mentioned, which is available on Amazon, who's ever listening to this. And Greg has the name and other information about the book.
I do. And it is called I Came Here Seeking a Person, One Gay Man's Spiritual Journey. We will put a link to that book on our website at outbeatnews.com. Just click on show notes at the top of the page. I strongly encourage anybody who maybe sounds anything like I've described tonight to pick up the book and read it. And even if you're not, it's a fascinating story. I love memoirs. And it's definitely worth picking up.
Thank you for that.
Bill Glenn, thank you so much for who you are and for sharing your story with us tonight and for helping me out.
Greg, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure talking to whoever's listening to this. We all need each other. We all need modeling from each other. I'm still a work in progress. I'm thinking when I'm 85, I'll peak and I'll be okay then. But I used to think when I was a therapist, when I'm 50, it'll be over. We're all works of progress, in progress. Thank you so much.
I think you have a lot more to give. Thank you. And we'll be back with more right after this music break. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Outbeat News in Depth here on KRCB Radio. I'm Greg Moralia. Next up, it's Rafe DeRozzi with this month's HIV Roundup.
Hi, and welcome to the HIV News Roundup for October 2025. We're at a critical moment in the global HIV response. On one side, rapid scientific breakthroughs and promising access developments. On the other, strained delivery systems, shifting funding landscapes, and institutional instability. This month saw both uplifting advances and sharp warnings about what lies ahead. I'll take you through the key stories: global access and cost breakthroughs, U.S. funding strategy shifts, scientific and clinical advances, regional alerts, and what it all means going forward. One of the most encouraging developments this month, a new analysis shows the long-acting prevention injection lenacapavir, administered twice yearly, could be mass-produced for as little as $25 per person per year, if generic licensing and large-scale manufacturing are achieved. That is transformational because currently, list prices for similar drugs in high-income settings run in the tens of thousands of dollars. If that gap can be bridged, the access implications for low- and middle-income countries are enormous. Meanwhile, the Maldives became the first country in the world to achieve triple elimination of mother-to-child transmission of HIV, syphilis, and hepatitis B. A public health milestone underscoring what's possible when integrated care and sustained political commitment align. The U.S. government announced a $115 million bridge funding package to sustain HIV programs in South Africa through March 2026, preventing immediate service disruptions after months of uncertainty. At the same time, Washington continues to pivot its global health approach toward bilateral partnerships and country ownership. While that may encourage local autonomy, experts warn it could weaken multilateral coordination and pooled procurement systems that have long underpinned HIV treatment and prevention scale-up. In the UK, regulators approved nationwide rollout of cabotegravir, long-acting injectable PrEP, for people unable to take daily oral pills, a major step for equitable prevention access. For context, this is a once-every-two-month prevention from Vive Healthcare versus lenacapavir's once-every-six-month prevention from Gilead Sciences. At international conferences including EACS or the European AIDS Clinical Society and ID Week 2025, researchers shared encouraging updates on next-generation HIV cure strategies. One of the most discussed was the reactivate and kill approach, a modern refinement of the older shock and kill concept. The idea is to reactivate dormant HIV hiding in immune cells, known as the latent reservoir, making those infected cells visible to the body's defenses, and then target and destroy them using tools like broadly neutralizing antibodies or engineered T cells. Earlier versions of this strategy struggled because the drugs used to shock the virus were often too weak or too toxic. This new generation aims for precise reactivation with fewer side effects and pairs it with stronger immune-based killing mechanisms. While still in early research stages, this renewed progress signals that the field is slowly moving from controlling HIV toward potentially curing it, or at least shrinking the viral reservoir enough to sustain drug-free remission. The World Health Organization and UNAIDS issued a regional alert highlighting concerning trends in several Western Pacific nations. In Papua New Guinea, the country declared a national HIV crisis in June 2025. Approximately 30 new HIV infections occur each day, totaling an estimated 11,000 new cases in 2024 alone. This marks a doubling of new HIV infections since 2010, with a significant rise in cases among women and children, particularly due to high rates of mother-to-child transmission. In January, the Fiji government declared an HIV outbreak following a sharp increase in new diagnoses. Since 2014, the number of new HIV infections in Fiji has risen tenfold, with a threefold increase in 2024 alone compared to the previous year. Injection drug use has been identified as a major contributing factor, with concerns about potential spillover of infections to other Pacific Island countries. In the Philippines, between 2010 and 2024, new HIV infections increased approximately sixfold, with young men who have sex with men being the most affected group. This surge has made the Philippines the fastest-growing HIV epidemic in the Asia-Pacific region. These country-specific factors, ranging from limited testing and treatment access to behavioral and structural risks, help explain why infections are rising despite broader global progress. Still, October brings genuine reasons for optimism. The Maldives elimination milestone, cost-lowering potential for long-acting PrEP, and expanded prevention rollouts all show that progress is possible when science, policy, and equity align. The challenge ahead is ensuring those wins are sustained, that breakthroughs translate into access, and access into impact. Progress in HIV isn't just about innovation. It's about stewardship, accountability, and communities driving change. For continuing coverage, follow my channel under Raif Durazi. For Outbeat News in depth, I'm Raif Durazi.
Thanks, Raif. Well, earlier this month, Finn Dearheart sat down for a conversation with Griffin Hansberry about his novel, Some Strange Music Draws Me In. Griffin is a trailblazer in the field of psychoanalysts and was the first analyst to practice and publish as an openly transgender person.
Welcome, Griffin Hansberry, to Outbeat News.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, Griffin is an author, many books that he has written, and this particular novel, Some Strange Music Draws Me In, is the book that got me interested in his work, and I'm going to put that in the show notes for the listeners. Cannot recommend this book enough. Griffin, I'd love it if you could just share a little bit with our listeners about your process of writing this book, like what drew you to write this book.
Sure, yeah.
Move into a little bit of content about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it started with an experience that I had when I was about 12 or 13 years old, growing up in my small working class town, where there was a trans woman who was in town, which was very unusual for that place. And I found myself sort of inexplicably excited by this and saw her outside the post office one day and went to look for her. Really didn't understand why I was looking for her. Went to look for her and I never found her. So the book is really sort of like starts off as sort of a what if a kid like me had found her and came to sort of understand themselves as trans and queer and also got introduced to some great music like the music of Patti Smith, which is throughout the book, sort of opened up a whole new world. So that was really the jumping off point and just sort of went from there and spun a story from that little tiny detail.
I did not know that, and I'm so glad that I asked that question to hear you say that, because that is like this like hinge moment that, so it's almost like what you're saying, I think, is that you wrote the what if you had come across this person. And yeah, wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, exactly. Just, you get to sort of, in some ways, rewrite history or play out a fantasy that didn't get to happen.
Totally. And in the process, like getting to live into the emotional material that is connected to that what if story. Yeah.
Exactly,
When
exactly.
you were writing this book, did you, what was the process like for you in writing it? Did it bring up a lot of stuff that you had to work through, or did it feel like you'd metabolized a lot of that already and could just like throw it down on paper? Like, what was that like?
I think I started writing in about 20, I want to say 2017, I think it was. And I started with the 1984 story. So the book moves back and forth mostly in 1984, but also has these 2019 sections. So I wrote all of 1984 and relied somewhat on some of my, I'm like a, kind of compulsive personal archivist. So I have diaries and I have, notes that friends passed me in class and, lots of stuff like that. So I had some of that material that I relied on. And I'm also very, I can be very obsessive about specificity about the past. So the stuff in 1984 is really, whatever, whether it was like a candy bar or a TV show or all of the sort of, maybe at this point, nostalgic sort of details really is very on point. So I had fun doing that, and and then I really had to figure out, because I was not myself at 13, very conscious. I don't think a lot of 13-year-olds are very conscious about what they're going through. So I really had to kind of retroactively imagine myself into that experience and what it felt like, and how I might have thought and felt, or how somebody like me might have thought and felt. So it's very much fiction, but sort of like, going through my own experience to imagine an experience that at the time, even though I was living it, I wasn't thinking it,
I love that aspect that you just shared about the, it's kind of like a retroactive way of imagining what that person, Mel, in the book, the character of Mel, had been going through. I think that was part of what really lit me up about this book, was the awareness, because like I, in my own process of queerness too, getting to identify with both the character Mel and then Max later, and seeing versions of myself in these two characters, which are the same person's arc of life. Just really think that's a cool detail that you just shared. Was there any part in writing this book that felt challenging for you to work through, like in the writing process?
I think writing is always challenging, in so many ways for me. Like, I'm trying to think in particular with this book. I think a lot of it too, where my mind's going is more to Max. He takes up, he's the middle-aged trans guy that Mel becomes in 2019. And when I first sent out the book, my agent first sent out the book, got a lot of feedback that Max was too angry, and so
It's so annoying.
I'm very pro anger, but a lot of people really have a problem with anger. So I had to sort of deal with that? Was there a way I needed to tone him down? Was there a way, were there parts I needed to keep? So really kind of like figuring that out was a challenge. And then also working with, the character Sylvia, the trans woman. She's a young woman. She's hanging out with kids and drinking beer with them. And I wanted to make sure that she was not perfect, not like sort of idealized character, but also, not somebody who was sort of going to be seen as corrupting in any way. So that was a difficult balance to strike.
Yeah, that sounds like that would be challenging to write that in. Also, just from my own personal experience, thinking about like my relationships with people that were older than me at that time and how the erotic is always coming in, like in our experiences from way back in little childhood, so it's kind of like how to write that with sensitivity and illustrate that it is there, but also not in a way that people are going to start like declaring what this is and freaking out or whatever, but to like just there, even the title, okay, Some Strange Music Draws Me In. I think that I'm asking you actually, I know that's a reference to Patti Smith's music, but it's also, isn't it not like that's music that Mel is hearing and like drawing her into an experience of herself that she hasn't yet known or known how to talk about?
Exactly. Yeah, and you say it perfectly. It's really, it's a line from a Patti Smith song, and it's also, a metaphor not just for music but for the strangeness of becoming something other than what you were told to become, right? And whether that's, I mean, many of us, queer and not queer, have that experience of, coming into contact with art, other forms of art, besides music or other types of people. Someone with an interesting haircut comes into your life and wakes something up in you, right? So,
Totally.
fashion, all kinds of other kinds of expression that you don't find in, conservative small towns so much. Certainly not back in 1984, and much today too. Yeah. So it's really
I'm
about
curious.
like coming into contact with difference, right?
Like the other, right? It's in like how that I love it because it too, like the drawing in part that really resonates with me, and just seeing how we're if we allow ourselves to be drawn toward or whatever, and to stay open to what pulls on us and what that can do for us.
Exactly. And there are, of course, people in the town like Mel's best friend who doesn't want to be drawn in, who says like that's, the word different. This was something that I put in the book, but that people that I grew up with would say if there was something that sort of troubled them, they would say, well, that's different, and it was an insult. And it was also sort of like they were saying, I don't want to be drawn into that difference. I'm going to stay away from it. There's something threatening about it to the person's sense of integrity or coherence that they feel they need to avoid. They need to stay with the sameness in order to remain themselves, remain safe.
Safe.
Yeah.
Yeah, defended maybe. Maybe. I'm curious like how you're keeping your if you are keeping your creative process going right now in these times of peril for people, and to maybe use this as a place to look at for our listeners, if you're a creative person, we have a lot of people who are creatives in this area, how to keep your process alive whenever you're feeling fear.
Yeah, it's really hard. I find that it's been really difficult for me to really produce anything new, work on a larger project. I haven't really been able to do that. My mind just can't focus. But I've gone back to journaling. I mean, I've been journaling, since I was a kid. So I've really been leaning into both doing my own journaling and also going back to my journals. What I've been doing is the ones that are all written on paper, I'm going in and I'm sort of not transcribing them word for word, but sort of transcribing, summarizing, going over them so that I have them digitally. They'll be easier to carry if I have to carry them somewhere. And they're also more easily searchable. But the process has been really very generative for me in terms of just looking at my own arc through life. And so that's been what I'm doing. I really think the journaling is great because it's low pressure. I'm not trying to produce a book that I want to get published. I'm not trying to produce something that I'm going to share with anybody. This is really just for me, and it keeps those gears turning. And then I also think, like, sometimes I'll, there are projects I sort of have open, and so dipping in and really trying to give myself permission to not be productive, but to find out, like, what do I feel like working on today? There's a screenplay, there's a novel. Maybe I go in and I spend a couple hours with it, and it's not all day, or it's, maybe I generate a paragraph, or maybe I only generate, a thought, some notes, and really, really let that be enough.
Totally.
Yeah.
And even like this idea that even reading can be writing, right? It's like if I'm taking in material and letting it act in myself, and I try to remind myself that same thing too. I'm not producing a lot and just like, well, okay, but I had this major process today around my dad or whatever, and does that count? And it does for me, think the last thing I'd like to touch on with you is I'd read your one of your papers, one of your academic papers that talks about the transgender edge, and really loved the language of that and the concept. I'm curious if you could just throw that concept out for our listeners and to think about that smile. You're like, throw that concept out.
I do that.
And really, here's the invitation, I think, for the listeners, whether you're identifying as cis or trans or what, however you're identifying yourself. To explore this idea of that edge inside of oneself, and to be orienting inward versus into this, thinking about identities and in the outward sense.
Just thinking about how to sort of frame that. Maybe in terms of so much of identity, and especially gender, relies on a lot of policing from the outside, policing of the self, sort of, patrolling the borders of what that is, right? And what would happen if those borders were a little less patrolled, and to sort of be open to the ways in which, very Freudian, right? We all sort of start off, he talked about psychic bisexuality, but beyond the binary, sort of all starting off with a sort of multiplicity of sort of gendered and embodied sort of expressions of self, and to sort of, notice maybe when there are moments that might feel a little uncomfortable around that, and to notice how that feels in the body, how you respond to it. Do you want to go away from it? Notice that you want to go away from it, and maybe just don't have to go towards it. Don't have to be drawn into that strange music, but maybe just sort of like be with it and don't have to do anything with it except let it be there. And
Love
see what
that.
it's like to let it be there, right? I mean, this just sort of goes into, like, really, on a very micro level, noticing what happens in the body when you let it be there. Maybe
That's
something
awesome.
that's tense can relax. Maybe something gets more tense. It's just information. It doesn't have to mean anything,
Love that invitation. Actually, I think that's so immediately applicable as you're describing it. And I do think that's something that everyone can do if they're interested and willing to explore that. Like, what is this edge here? I'm gonna be thinking about that because and we don't have the time to explore all this right now. But this assumption that cisgender is like it is by fiat, like it just is, and then like transgender is this space of like the malleability, and it's like no, this is all constructed. And if cis people would start to investigate that, what that could do culturally for our communities as queer people.
Absolutely. Yeah, it can be really liberating.
Well, Griffin, that is all the time that we have for Outbeat time. I really appreciate you making yourself available for this conversation. And again, if you are listening, check out the book, Some Strange Music Draws Me In by Griffin Hansberry. We'll put that in the show notes, that link. Griffin, if anyone would like to reach out to you to connect, is there a way that they can do that that's preferable for you?
Yeah, sure. Probably Instagram. I'm at Vanishing NY, Vanishing New York. That's a great place to reach me. And thank you for having me on. So as always, a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And that wraps up our show. Tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Radio's Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Grayer. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a great week, and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia. Our shows are available for on-demand play anytime on our website at outbeatnews.com and on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and now on iHeartRadio. Find links to subscribe at outbeatnews.com.
I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what. So I give it up to you.
You're broken down and tired of living life on the merry-go-round, and you can't find a fighter. But I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out. Move mountains. We gon' walk it out and move mountains. And now
support for Outbeat Radio on KRCB FM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County, with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB FM Rohnert Park and KRCG FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Le Jazz Hot is next.